Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Clay, you got to pot down that music. Thank you. And so, just an enormous amount of stuff going on. I just have to say, it's just an enormous amount of stuff going on. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Coming up on today's program, by the way, former CIA operative Robert Baer. Bob Baer is going to be here with his new book, Blow the House Down. Right now, Ted Gale and Carly, and we're going to be talking about this whole thing with Zarqawi, the Paris Hilton tax cut, other events in the news, what happened with the elections yesterday. Lots and lots going on here as we continue with this with the program throughout this first hour and throughout all 3 hours of our program. But first, Ted Galen Carpenter, the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, cato.org. The website is on the air with us. Hey, Ted. Ted? No, Ted.
Afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Ted. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Great to have you with us. You have written a piece, an op-ed piece, suggesting that China represents a growing threat to the United States. Can you lay this premise out to us?
Well, that's actually based on a new book that I have out, America's Coming War with China, A Collision Course Over Taiwan. And it doesn't suggest that China is a general threat to the United States. I don't believe it is. There are some neoconservatives out there especially who seem to think that the Chinese are 15 feet tall and they're plotting to take over the world. I don't buy into that. But Taiwan is one of those explosive issues that could lead to an armed conflict between the United States and China, with neither side really wanting it.
Well, in fact, to the best of my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong on this, the Chinese general who said that if we tried to prevent China from taking Taiwan, we would be hit by over 100 nuclear missiles, has not been removed from his position.
No, the only thing the Chinese government said is that he was expressing his personal opinion, right. Not the official policy of the Chinese government, but if you know the Chinese political system, you know high-level officials don't go around expressing their personal opinion without clearance.
Right, or if they do, they're no longer high-level officials.
That's right.
They're called internees and organ donors.
Yeah, they will suddenly have severe health problems and have to resign.
Yeah. So, what fascinates me, we're talking with Ted Galen Carpenter of the Vice President of Defense and Foreign Policy Study at the Cato Institute, cato.org. For a long time, I've had a real problem with this, and it almost seems like an internal schizophrenia at Cato, as well as at a lot of other organizations, about the concern, the legitimate concern, because I'm right there with you, about a communist dictatorship, that being communist China. And you know, anybody who doesn't think it's a dictatorship should, you know, hop on a plane, go over there and try to stand in Tiananmen Square and make a few political statements. A communist dictatorship that is growing like crazy in wealth, in military might, and in political power around the world, largely as a consequence of U.S. trade policies.
Well, certainly.
Which you guys support.
Well, we favor economic engagement with China, believing that that is the best route to eventual political liberalization in that country. There's no guarantee that's going to happen, but that's the best course of action. We tried the policy of trying to isolate China. That was our policy from the time of the Communist Revolution in 1949 until the Kissinger-Nixon breakthrough in 1971-72. That policy didn't work at all. It led to an insular, angry, very volatile and dangerous China. As bad as China is today, and it certainly has a long way to go before the people there have decent freedoms, it is a far sight better than the China that existed 35, 40, 50 years ago.
Are you suggesting then that our policies with North Korea are misguided?
Absolutely. I think the policies of trying to isolate countries like North Korea, Cuba, Iran have been disastrous failures. I don't think we need any more evidence of that. We try to isolate those regimes, and all we get are surly reactions from those countries And we now are in the lovely position of having two countries that are about to enter the global nuclear weapons club, North Korea and Iran, with whom we have no formal relations whatsoever. That is not only misguided, it is profoundly dangerous.
Right, and they're both doing it in large part. I mean, both of them had their reactors under seal, and they were being monitored by the UN. They're both doing it in large part because Bush named them Axis of Evil countries. I mean, basically, he kicked over the beehive here.
Well, I had a piece in the Los Angeles Times back in the spring of 2003 that said that one of the inadvertent consequences of hostile U.S. policies, and especially what we were doing with Iraq, was to convince North Korea, Iran, and potentially other countries that they need a nuclear deterrent to prevent the United States from contemplating forcible regime change in their case. That's certainly not what Washington intended, but I think that is one of the consequences of the kinds of policies we pursued.
Doesn't seem to me like it's rocket science, Ted Carpenter. I just, you know, the fact that the Bushies hadn't anticipated this just causes me to shake my head in amazement. But back to China for a minute. You have, I think, correctly identified China as a potential threat, particularly around the Taiwan issue. And I've been in China, and I've spent a lot of time in Taiwan, and lived in China for just a month. But I've been through Taiwan many, many times over the 30-year period, and seeing the political changes in Taiwan as it has, the ebb and flow of nationalism, shall we say, over the years, over the last three decades anyway. And it seems to me that the main thing that is driving the growth of China is the transfer to China of technology and manufacturing expertise from the United States as a consequence of free trade policy, of so-called free trade policies, and that doesn't it seem appropriate that there should be some kind of a middle ground where instead of simply saying to American corporations, yes, now you can do away with all those American jobs and ship them all over to China, we're going to do away with all the tariffs that used to keep those jobs here in the United States, and on the one hand, and on the other hand saying, no, we're never going to do any business with them because they're a communist state. What about some sort of a middle ground where, yes, we will engage them? I mean, isn't this what Nixon was talking about, essentially? Let's engage them. Let's do trade with them. But let's not do it in a way that where the big winners are the multinational corporations and the Chinese military, and the big losers are the American middle class.
Well, the one thing you have to realize is the United States is only one actor in this picture. China gets a lot of trade and investment from Taiwan itself. Indeed, that's the one hope I have, that maybe war can be avoided. If they didn't have that kind of economic linkage, war would be a virtual certainty. Japan,
don't
the European
think each,
Union,
each thinks
country.
It's going to absorb the other.
I'm sorry.
With regard to Taiwan and China, I've gotten the sense over the years that each thinks that it's ultimately going to absorb the other.
Well, I think the Taiwanese hope that eventually the mainland will democratize, that Taiwan will have that kind of influence. The mainland, though, I think, assumes that sooner or later it will be strong enough to resolve the Taiwan issue on its terms, meaning forcible reunification. And I suspect that within a decade to two decades, China is going to make that kind of bid, regardless of the economic ties between China and Taiwan, as important as those are. I don't think ultimately that will determine the relationship between those two states.
Yeah, we just have a couple of minutes left here. We're talking with Ted Galen Carpenter, Vice President of Defense and Foreign Policy Study at the Cato Institute, cato.org. Ted, there are those who suggest that the U.S. government is setting up a massively inflationary scenario with the, you know, $9 trillion of government borrowing, $600 billion annual current account deficits. We're creating a situation where the U.S. dollar has to fall through the floor. The Chinese are holding enormous numbers of dollars right now, trillions of dollars of dollars. And yet they have said recently that they're going to slow down the rate at which they're acquiring these dollars. Do you think that one of the reasons why China has not been belligerent toward us is because, and has not like started dumping dollars, is because they're so dependent on us because of that ownership of those dollars? And B, do you see them doing something about that quickly that might, if they do it real quickly, wipe out our currency?
Well, I am not an economist, so you're a little outside my area of expertise, but I think that the Chinese don't want to use that economic leverage at this time. they are probably waiting for a crucial moment, very likely with regard to the Taiwan issue, in which they will threaten to dump dollars if the U.S. proposes to intervene in a crisis in the Taiwan Strait. That's what we have to worry about when the Chinese Central Bank has become our chief creditor for government debt.
Right. So because of the Bush and Reagan borrow and spend policies, we are now, you know, the Chinese have us by the proverbial short hairs.
We have a serious problem there, not only the Chinese central bank holding that debt, but central banks throughout East Asia. It's not a comfortable situation.
Yeah, and Saudi Arabia as well. Ted Galen Carpenter, Vice President of Defense and Foreign Policy Study at the Cato Institute, cato.org, the website. Thanks, Ted, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this song. I could kill a couple minutes just talking to lieutenants about Saddam Hussein. I could grasp what they were saying and the dangerous game we're playing if I only had a brain.
If only.
With my thoughts unconstipated, I'd be intellectualated and thinking without pain. Each executive decision would be based on more than wishing if I only had a brain.
And welcome back. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. And a time for a look at what's happening in Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
There's some Reuters recent developments, security developments in Iraq. In Baghdad, a car bomb killed two people and wounded 12 others near a Baghdad and near a market in Baghdad's northwestern Shula district. In Yousafia, gunman shot dead police captain Saad Khalid al-Rabi. In Mosul, gunman shot dead three university students in Mosul. Three people, including a policeman, were killed in Mosul in a drive-by shooting. In Bakhaba, two Iraqi soldiers were killed and four were wounded. One of them died when a roadside bomb struck his patrol. Gunmen later opened fire on Iraqi troops coming to evacuate the wounded, killing a second soldier. Also in Bakaba, gunmen stormed two neighboring shops and killed their two owners in that city. 13 in Baghdad, 13 out of some 50 Iraqi transport workers who were abducted earlier this week were found alive, but some showed signs of torture and had been shot in the foot. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed when a roadside bomb struck his convoy. Also in Baghdad, two police officers were killed and two policemen were wounded when a roadside bomb struck their vehicle in eastern Baghdad. Also in Baghdad, gunmen in a car shot dead four policemen and wounded another in an attack in their patrol in Baghdad. In Hawija, gunmen in a Sunni mosque killed a Sunni mosque preacher in the town of Hawija, 60 kilometers southwest of the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. In Baghdad, police found five bodies, two of them women, in different parts of Baghdad. And in Baghdad, a mortar round landed in a house, killing a man and wounding his son in eastern Baghdad. And, of course, the largest story, the hottest story, the one that the Bush administration is flogging like crazy, is al-Zarqawi was terminated. He died overnight or yesterday in Iraq as a result of U.S. bombing missions. And here's what I find interesting about this. Back in 2004, according to the Washington Post, a U.S. military briefing said, and I quote, this is a headline, "Villainize Zarqawi, leverage xenophobia response." This is from a report by Reuters published April 10, 2006, quoting the Washington Post in 2004. And in April of 2006, Reuters wrote, "The U.S. military is conducting a propaganda campaign to overstate the threat to the st- the threat to stability posed by the al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zarqawi in Iraq, the Washington Post reported on Monday. Some senior military intelligence officers believe the importance of the Jordanian-born Abu Musab al-Zarqawi may have been exaggerated, citing military documents and officers familiar with the program. According to the article, Colonel Derek Harvey, who served as a military intelligence officer in Iraq, told a U.S. Army meeting last summer, quote, "Our own focus on Zarqawi has enlarged his caricature, if you will, made him more important than he really is. The long-term threat is not Zarqawi or religious extremists, but these former regime types and their friends," Harvey said in a transcript of a meeting at Fort Leavenworth, Texas. I'm telling you, what this is all about is this is what anybody who has ever written fiction or paid attention to the storylines and plot lines of novels or movies knows. I've written 7 or 8 novels, and three of them have been turned into screenplays. 2 of them were optioned. I've been through a bunch of workshops, read a lot of books on this, and actually taught how to write fiction. And I can tell you, the first thing you learn is that your hero can only be a hero if there's a villain, and that the heroicness of your hero, the heroism of your hero, will be defined by the villainy of your villain. When DC Comic Books came up with Superman, a guy who can jump over tall buildings and see with X-ray vision and fly through the sky, it would have been the most boring comic book ever if they couldn't come up with Lex Luthor and Kryptonite. It just has to be. You have to have an evil villain in order to have a superhero. Now, George W. Bush, after the 2000 election, 2001, Americans are getting it. He wasn't legitimately elected. He didn't win the election. It was September. He knew that in 5 weeks, the Washington Post and the New York Times were going to report that he actually didn't win in Florida. And to his great fortune, and some would say because of his great incompetence, or perhaps because he even decided not to follow up on some of the leads that he had. We know now that Judy Cooper could have broken this story. George Bush now had a villain in the form of Osama bin Laden. So he could become the Superman to Osama bin Laden as Lex Luthor. He had a Lex Luthor. Well, he blew that over the course of 3 years. Osama bin Laden still running around, 6'4" on 6'6" on his camel with his dialysis machine. Bush can't find him. So he needed a new Lex Luthor. So, where do we get the Penguin? Where do we get the Joker? Ah, this is our Zarqawi guy. We'll get him. And I guarantee he's going to be crowing that he's now the king. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Lord have mercy on the blue collar man. Oh, Lord have mercy on the blue collar man.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You've heard folks argue that the Iraq War was a mistake. I've heard conservatives say, yeah, it was a mistake. We had mistaken intelligence. Setting aside Doug Feith running his little boiler room inside the Pentagon to pass phony information up to the press, up to Judy Miller, and up to the White House so that they could use it. But, you know, let's consider this. David Swanson wrote a great piece. He said, let's stay in Iraq until it's peaceful or we're sane, whichever comes first. Examining the logic of withdrawal. And it's based in part on a book by Anthony Arnov called The Logic, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. And it just lays out a couple of arguments that I think are really worth examining, particularly given today that George W. Bush, his most recently created boogeyman, his most recently created, as the Washington Post pointed out, the Pentagon and the Bush administration hyping Zarqawi so that they could have an evil face against which they could be fighting, right? So they could pretend that they were actually fighting a war rather than an insurgency. Although the Pentagon themselves will tell you that 90 to 95% of the attacks against Americans have nothing to do with al-Qaeda, and that al-Qaeda was not functioning inside Iraq before we got there. That 90 to 95% of the attacks in Iraq are from Iraqis who don't want us there or who are fighting against each other. It's like if Mexico one day, was to go to the United Nations and say, you know, that George W. Bush, he wasn't actually elected in 2000 or 2004. He rigged the elections, and he didn't have the right to go to war in Iraq. He's a war criminal. The guy's a war criminal, and he's illegitimate as a president. We're going to drive him out. We're going to liberate the American people. And Mexico invaded the United States. They started a shock and awe campaign, and they start bombing the cities across the United States, and then their army comes in, and Canada says, okay, we'll join you. We'll be part of the coalition of the willing. And we now have Canadian and Mexican soldiers from coast to coast in the United States and occupying our country. I would take a gun and go out in the streets and say, no, you don't. And you just think about it for a minute. If your country was and I don't like George W. Bush, I would defend our country against a Mexican or a Canadian invasion. So let's consider, you know, just think about that for a minute, and let's consider the logic of the right-wingers here. First of all, they say that the U.S. should stay in Iraq, even though it was a mistake. Well, number one, we have no right to be there in the first place. It was an illegal invasion. The country represented no threat to us. You had Hans Blix, you had the weapons inspectors saying that it represented no threat to us. Yes, I know the Bushies like to repeat over and over and over again on Fox News, oh, the French thought it was a threat, the British thought it was a threat, the Spanish thought it was a threat, the Italians thought it was a threat. Maybe at one point they did, but in the weeks before the invasion, they were listening to Hans Blix. And Hans Blix was saying pretty clearly and pretty unambiguously, there's no threat there. He was going on and on about it. You know, say, well, you know, people used to believe in witches too, but I'd like to see some evidence. You know, the world knew. In fact, in a week and a half before we invaded, the UN was going to, Hans Blix and Mohammed Al-Barr and I were going to submit a report to the UN saying, there's no evidence of weapons of mass destruction here. We have found the proof that they actually destroyed them. And Bush knew that. That's why he had to invade as quickly as he did. Because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to invade at all. So this was an illegal war. And it turns out the Iraqi war, as David Swanson writes, was not a mistake at all. And so the mistake cannot be continued even for an hour. It's not a war. It's a crime. Invading another country is a crime. Just like when Hitler invaded Poland, this is a crime. You stop crimes. Secondly, we are not bringing democracy to Iraq. As Arnold writes in his book, the U.S. government opposes genuine democracy in the United States for a simple reason. If ordinary people control the region's energy resources, they might be put toward local economic development and social needs rather than going to fuel the profits of Western oil companies. We don't support genuine democracy. We support an oligarchy. We want a relatively hand-picked group. We get to pick who people are going to vote on. But of people who are going to be favorable to the U.S. oil companies controlling the oil coming out of Iraq. And then on top of that, we have the problem that they just wrote into their constitution. Muslim law trumps everything. Iraq's constitution is not all that different from Iran's constitution right now. This is the democracy we're creating. Number three, they say, well, we're making the world a safer place by occupying Iraq. I'm sorry, I don't think so. I just like I don't think Mexico or Canada would make the world a safer place if they tried to occupy the United States. What we've done is established a legal, well, it's not legal, but we've established a precedent for countries to attack each other. We've caused other countries like Iran and North Korea to invest in nuclear weapons or start developing nuclear weapons because they see us as a country that will invade anybody who isn't strong enough to stop them. This is not making the world a safer place. It's making the world a more dangerous place. The Bush administration is contributing to warfare around the world. They are not contributing to peace around the world. Not only that, we've caused the rest of the world to hate us. We have done exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted us to do. Judy Miller was going to break this story in the New York Times, and the story was that that Al-Qaeda was freaked out because after they attacked the USS Cole, they couldn't get the Clinton administration and then the Bush administration to attack them. They couldn't get them to do it. Osama bin Laden wanted to be the big hero. He wanted to be the next Saladin. He wanted to be the big hero for the Arab world, the Muslim world. Yeah, I'm the guy. I'm your man. And the only way he could be the big hero is if the big, you know, guy on the street picked on him. He wanted the U.S. to turn him into a super enemy. And Bush needed a super enemy to become a superhero. It's a perfect symbiosis. It's the same thing that Tim McVeigh wanted when he blew up the McMurray building in Oklahoma City. He wanted the U.S. government to overreact and turn him into a super villain. He thought that that was going to cause an uprising of all the good white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in the United States to kill off all the people of color and Jews and Catholics and you know, all the good gun owners come out there and create a new America. He really believed that. He read the Turner Diaries. He actually believed that. He had the same worldview Osama bin Laden has. It was just Christian rather than Muslim. And Bill Clinton said, no, we're not going to play your game. You're a criminal. We're going to put you in jail. And if Bush had simply done that, when the Taliban said, okay, we'll turn Osama bin Laden over to any country that, you know, other than the United States, that will put him on, hold him for a fair trial. We'll turn him over to a European country. If Bush had said, fine, let's have a trial for this guy, it would have been the end of it. Because at that point, the rest of the Muslim world was so horrified by 9/11. I mean, there were peace vigils in Tehran, Iran. Candlelight vigils in support of the United States the day after 9/11. The rest of the world was horrified by Osama bin Laden. In particular, the Islamic world. They were not on his side until we started attacking Iraq. They say that we're preventing a civil war in Iraq. On the contrary, our occupation and the constitution we've imposed on Iraq, as David Swanson writes, deliberately pit ethnic groups against each other in an effort to direct violence away from us. Things are getting worse, not better. They say we're confronting terrorism in Iraq. No, I'm sorry, we're not. We are stirring up terrorism, and it's being directed against us. And let's keep in mind, again, Al-Qaeda arrived in Iraq after the invasion. They say we're honoring those who died by continuing to send more people to die in Iraq. I think the fallacy of that should be immediately obvious. And they say we're rebuilding Iraq. Well, why is it that right now, 3 years after the invasion, we've been fighting in Iraq almost as long as we fought World War II? In the next couple of months, it's going to be, well, actually, it's longer. I mean, for the time from Pearl Harbor to the end of World War II, to D-Day, or to VJ Day, the entire length of World War II for the United States was shorter than the period of time from 9/11 to today. And then we say, oh, we're rebuilding Iraq. Well, during that period of time, you know, in 3 years, we rebuilt an awful lot of Europe and Japan with the Marshall Plan. But in Iraq right now, people have less electricity than they had before we invaded. They have less clean water than before we invaded. They had less sewage than before we invaded. And they have massively higher unemployment than before we invaded. The best thing we can do for ourselves and for Iraq is to get out. Mike in Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Mike.
You sound absolutely despondent today, Tom. This seems like, you know, an American victory seems like the absolute worst thing that has happened. You seem, again, I hope you're not suicidal.
Nice try, Mike. I will give you, Mike, that the death of Zarqawi is a fine thing by me. And Bush has hyped this guy way beyond any reasonable thing. This is, you know, we're seeing more PR of the Bush administration. They're going to milk it for all they can get from it. These guys did an illegal war, and you're going to defend this, Mike?
Well, let me state this, because the screener said to me when I had said to him, my comment was that you're going to be despondent. He assumed that I was, you know, a right-wing conservative. And the fact
Well, Mike, I'm going to put you on hold. Oh, damn, I pushed the wrong button. Mike, I dropped you. Call back. We'll put you right on right after the break. And we'll continue the conversation. I appreciate people who disagree with me. More on the Iraq War, the death of al-Zarqawi, and your calls right after this. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, Mr. Politician, don't legislate my love. You're not walking in my shoes. Don't hide behind your religion. It's my right to marry whom I choose. It's not your place to call me a sinner or decide who to have as my mate. Don't twist the words of the Bible to make laws that discriminate.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Travis in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Travis, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing? I just wanted to say, just a fantastic show. You got the best show of all the talk radio. I just wish everyone could hear it. Really, I wanted to call in and I just talk briefly about your idea of, you know, how to win the water cooler wars. I think it's fantastic. I love your approach that, you know, every Republican that you talk to, first thing they want to talk about is Clinton did this. And I love your approach of basically it's like, well, you're exactly right. I can sit down and I'll tell you more about what Clinton did than what, you know, as a Republican you think he did. My basic point is that these days, because I used to be a Republican, I'm ex-military, and I just really have started paying attention in the last 5 years and have seen the light. But essentially, is what I try and get across to these people is, look, what we're talking about is that I'm just as upset with the Democrats and the DLC at the top of this party as I am the Republicans, because, you know, if you're not really paying attention and you're not understanding as an average person, you're going about your business because life is rosy and beautiful, you know, you don't understand how bad things are. But, you know, you kind of have to just take an approach of, look, I'm not here to argue about abortion, gays, guns, gods, all that. This is way bigger than that, and people need to start waking up. And I think, you know, when you go after it with that approach and you start, then you get into the issues, you can definitely turn them around more versus going after, you know, starting out with an approach of, oh, I can't stand you because you're a Republican and I'm a liberal.
Yeah. Well, and that's the game that they want to play. I mean, that's the, you get the Ann Coulter crowd out there, and you know, all they want to do is throw names and try and freak people out and cause people to hate each other. And it really doesn't do anything. It not only does it not do anything for discourse and for the United States of America, it actually harms this country.
Absolutely.
That kind of mudslinging sarcasm, you know, just it harms this country. We need to have rational conversations. Travis, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
You had a point you wanted to make?
Yeah, actually, I just have a question for you. Honestly,
sure.
I'm so frustrated with the DLC. I quit giving money, just like Bernie said. I just started donating to individual candidates instead of the Democratic Party. But who do you think, honestly, because I'd love to see you as a candidate, but if you want
not going to happen.
Who do you think seriously should be, you know, the nomination or should get the nomination?
For what?
For president. I mean, who should we run? We need somebody that can come out, a new face, you know, that's not part of the oligarchy that we've had. And I mean, who do you honestly think is somebody?
My personal favorites are Howard Dean, Barbara Boxer, Russ Feingold, and Al Gore. And John Edwards. I'd put John Edwards in there as well. Any of those guys, I'd vote for in a heartbeat. But here's, Travis, here's something that you're probably not going to expect to hear me say. If Hillary Clinton is the nominee for the Democratic Party, I would vote for her and work for her. Even Hillary Clinton, who is probably as far away from me as you can get inside the Democratic Party. And the reason why is I look back at what happened in 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt was elected president. We were just sliding into the Great Depression. Things were really bad. Herbert Hoover, the Republican, was basically a Bush Republican. I mean, there'd been a series of 6 big tax cuts. He was basically following laissez-faire economics, Republican policies. And Roosevelt got himself elected in 32 essentially as a conservative Democrat. He was not proposing things like Social Security, unemployment insurance, bring in the unions, all that kind of stuff. He was not. He wouldn't have gotten elected had he done that. He got elected as a conservative, and then he got into power, and he made some changes. And I just have a lot of hope that if a lot of us get involved at the grassroots in the party, that we can turn our elected officials around faster than we can probably find the perfect candidate to go up against them. Now,
right.
there are some that I've given up on. Joe Lieberman, I've just walked away from. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. You know, to follow up with that, I mean, I think really that's what we need is someone that's willing to come to the table and say and really start screaming and pointing in the neocons' face and say to the Republicans, look, we will work with you. You know, I mean, basically, if a left-wing candidate is going to win, you know, it drives me crazy, this issue with this immigration and with guns. Get as far away from that as possible.
The Democrats have taken a totally insane losing position on immigration, and they waffled their way into it, and there's still a lot of debate inside the Democratic Party about it, but it is going to kill them. I'll tell you, it is absolutely going to kill them. Travis, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. Ed in San Juan, California. Hey Ed, we have 1 minute left. What's up?
Okay. Well then, I want you to be king. If you
not going to happen either.
Just I put my tinfoil.
I'm having a good time being
today.
A talk show host. We're going to stay there.
I put my tinfoil hat on today. If they drop 2 500-pound bombs on a house and they show the picture of it exactly the way it's supposed to be, then the picture that they're showing of Zarqawi laying there dead is an absolute lie.
I would say 2 500-pound bombs would turn anybody in a house into hamburger.
He would be no bigger than a piece of hamburger, and that shows a perfect picture. He hasn't even been in a good fist fight.
Oh, interesting. So I haven't seen the video of it yet. I came in here to start show prep on the radio program at 3 o'clock this morning and haven't seen the TV screen. I know they're just now starting to show the video.
But guess what? Look at the pictures. When they flew the plane into the Pentagon, the people in the Pentagon didn't come out perfect.
Yeah, coincidence or conspiracy? Ed, thanks for the call.
Bye.
I'll have to check that out. We'll have a little more conversation about that as time goes on. In fact, the studio next to me has a TV set, and I'll go over and see if they got any pictures. Fascinating stuff. We'll continue this conversation in the next hour. Plus, we have coming up Bob Baer, CIA operative and author of Blow the House Down. Is he going to be suggesting we should invade Iran? It's going to be an interesting conversation, I guarantee you. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 956 days, 11 hours, 54 minutes, 8 seconds. Until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves the White House, barring an impeachment process between now and then. Welcome back to the program. In our last segment, somebody called and said I should run for king. I'll tell you how I'll be king in the next segment. This is an interesting story. We'll get to this. Bob Baer is with us. Bob Baer wrote the book See No Evil that was made into the George Clooney flick Syriana. He also wrote a book called Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. His newest book, this is a novel this time, Blow the House Down. Bob Baer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here, Bob. Bob, in this book, by writing fiction, you have been able to say some of the things that the CIA wouldn't let you say in nonfiction. Is that an accurate statement?
Oh, absolutely. You know, two things. The CIA wouldn't let me write about the Iranian connection to 9/11. And number two, I get to take on these fictional truths, and they are fictional truths, surrounding 9/11, the whole conspiracy theory idea of what other countries were involved, was an individual involved, an American, questions like that, and put it in a dramatic arc.
So do you want to talk about this in a dramatic arc context? do we need to... Because I'd like to say, you know, was Iran involved in 9/11? What countries were involved in 9/11?
I think that there, at some level there was Saudi involvement. Obviously,
14 of the 19 guys were Saudis. That would
make 15
sense.
Were Saudis. They 15. Came from Saudi Arabia. They were recruited there. Presumably they were vetted there. And a lot of the money came from Saudi Arabia, but nobody's been indicted. Why?
Right. What's wrong with this picture? Well, could it have to do with the fact that Salman bin Laden, Osama's half-brother, bailed out George W. Bush's failing Arbusto oil company, or that another one of Osama bin Laden's brothers was having breakfast with George Herbert Walker Bush at the moment the towers were hit?
Well, there's this is what I'm trying to deal with in fiction. And the other question is Iran. You know, Iran was set up a strategic relationship with bin Laden in 1996. This I know for sure. And there's a lot of questions out there.
But bin Laden is a Sunni Arab, and Iran is a Shia country. Why would they do that?
No, tactical alliances. Anything that's anti-American. Anything that's going to cause the United States problems, these people unite.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, exactly. And they know this. You know, there's, you know, the 9/11 Commission report talks about Iran, saying there's a lot of tantalizing leads, but where does it all go? We need to investigate this, which isn't good enough. Or why in January 2 the hijackers came to California and the CIA didn't tell the FBI until August 2001. I mean, the FBI could have rolled all these guys up had they been given a chance.
Bob Baer, you were 20 years a CIA field operative in Europe and the Middle East, quit the agency in 1999. In your opinion, was there, I mean, and we just learned now here that Judy Miller could have blown the 9/11 story in July of 2001, and that might have caused it not to have happened. Were there folks with inside the United States government who would profit tremendously, perhaps politically rather than financially, but whatever, who would profit from 9/11, who worked to allow 9/11 to happen?
Well, let me put it this way. A lot of people have profited from 9/11. You are seeing great fortunes made, whether they're on the stock market or selling weapons or just contractors. Great fortunes are being made. I mean, you can't even touch property prices in Washington, D.C., and you have to ask that question. You know, is it possible to profit from 9/11 and hide it? Yes. I've talked to accounting firms. I know the way it's done. Layered accounts.
What about political profit? I mean, there are those who suggest that George W. Bush and or Cheney, Rumsfeld, Feith, Wolfowitz, Pearl, somebody in that chain of command or in that cabal had pretty good knowledge that 9/11 was going to happen and really didn't do much to stop it or even obstructed efforts to stop it because they thought that it would lend legitimacy to Bush's, what at that point in 2001 was a failing presidency.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what we're doing is we're looking at motivation. I mean,
right. How
can you, with the intelligence we knew that indicted Saudi Arabia and Iran, how can you go to war with Iraq and lie about the connections between bin Laden and Saddam? Now, that was an out-and-out lie. You know, they knew that there was no connection. They knew the connection was, as I said, with Iran and Saudi Arabia. So what is going on in their minds? And as they sold this war to us on false information.
Well, you're the guy who was in the business. I mean, what was going through their minds?
This is what, you know, we'd blow the house down. This is what they wanted to do. They needed a pretext to go into Iraq.
This is what you're speculating about in your novel. We're talking with Robert Baer. He's the author of a new novel, Blow the House Down. His first nonfiction. This is your first fiction book, isn't it?
First fiction. Yeah. It's very perilous waters, by the way, fiction.
Yeah, I can tell you, having written some of it myself.
It's not something that people like to read, you know, on, you know, Sunday afternoon as they're relaxing.
Yeah. See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, his previous books. And so are you just, you know, personally of the opinion? I mean, not obviously you can't speak for the CIA or your previous activities with the agency, but are you of the opinion that there was an aspect of inside job to 9/11 within the U.S. government?
There's that possibility. The evidence points at it.
And why is it not being investigated?
Why isn't the WMD story being investigated? Why isn't anybody been held accountable for 9/11? I mean, you know, we held people accountable after Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, why has there been no change of command? Why has there been no political repercussions? Why has there been no any sort of exposure on this? It really makes you wonder.
Yeah, those are all good questions. Do you have any answers for any of them?
I don't have any answers, but there are answers out there. I've got pieces of the story, and this is what I did in the book.
And bring
this out and blow the house down. I bring this out in fiction, which is why so many people are really irritated in Washington at me.
For having written this book.
Yeah, well, I left Washington anyhow. Exactly.
Yeah, interesting. Larissa Alexandrova over at Raw Story is writing about how in Ohio, during the last election, the 2004 election, there are actually people involved in the voting process, you know, actually, you know, like county clerks types folks who have come forward and said that they will give signed and sworn statements that there was massive vote fraud. And yet the FBI refuses to investigate it. I mean, it's like this just continues. Has a coup already happened in the United States and we just haven't realized it?
Well, what they do is use the White House and the executive branch to control information, and control information you can control power. And only if we throw Congress out and get a new Congress that's willing to deal with the accountability issues here for all across the board are we going to ever get answers that we need to get. And this is what like books like mine will find a certain audience for, because people doubt the federal government, and I do as well.
Well, that would, you know, fairly obviously, Robert Baer, the author of Blow the House Down, fairly obviously that would mean getting rid of the Republican-controlled House and Senate, but are the Democrats going to do any better? Are they going to investigate this thing?
I'd like to throw the whole bunch out.
And replace them with what, Ralph Nader and his friends?
Well, you know, there's a political leadership out there that's afraid to stick its head up, and I'd like to see him, you know, get some courage and do it. We don't know
right now, Bob Baer, if the reason why George W. Bush has the NSA spying on people is because he's spying on his political enemies.
Well, there you can. That's just open. The whole thing could be abuse if you know, without FISAs, without getting warrants to get into people's telephones. You wonder about the direction of the country, and it makes you worry. And, you know, if we go into war with Iran, we effectively will be at war with all of Islam, and we're talking about 100 years war. Which, you know, I've got my problems about with the Iranians, but we don't need another war in the Middle East.
So we just have a minute left, Bob Baer. You, author of Blow the House Down, you're of the opinion that Iran had something to do with 9/11, that Iran actually is a terrorist state and does represent a threat to stability in the world, and yet at the same time that we shouldn't invade Iran. What should we do?
We start talking. We should have been doing this years ago, talking to Iran and telling the truth about Iran first and foremost.
Well, in 98, Clinton offered to talk with Iran unconditionally, and they turned him down.
Well, that's the hardliners are in power, and they benefited from this. They were named in Khobar, an Iranian intelligence officer, but the Clinton White House didn't want to name them because they didn't want to press the Iranians. Or you can it's the carrot and stick approach on this whole thing. But the problems go back to 79. The whole thing was mishandled, and we're suffering for it today.
Well, arguably, they go back to 52, 53. But, yeah, well said. Robert Baer, his book, Blow the House Down. It's a novel. The New York Times bestselling author, Bob Baer. Check it out. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. And as I said, Bob's previous books, See No Evil, was made into the movie Syriana with George Clooney, who played Bob Baer, basically, and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. His new book, Blow the House Down. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. Victoria Jones is with us, our senior measles reporter in New York City today.
Yes.
Hey, Victoria Jones.
I've got no spots as far as I can tell. So far,
okay.
So good.
All right.
I already had it, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, I understand that you have somebody with you who has something to say about that, though.
I do. Yes, we're broadcasting today from the United Nations as their first ever radio day, and I have with me Dr. John Hoekstra, who's the senior health advisor in the program division at UNICEF. And not only does he coordinate health response in emergencies, but he's the guy who's responsible for getting the number of measles deaths down worldwide. So here he is, Dr. Hoekstra. This is Tom Hartman.
Thank you.
Doctor,
good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Hoekstra. Congratulations. The near eradication of measles around the world is a huge thing, but I understand from recent news stories I've read that measles may be making a comeback.
That is true, but the good thing is that the comeback is very limited, and what we consider now as a big problem is very limited compared to the problems we used to have. We were talking about in the past thousands and hundreds of thousands of children getting measles. Now we often have talk about maybe 8 or 20 kids getting measles, and that has become a problem. But
right,
what we're focusing on is basically getting those countries, and there's about 50 countries in the world where they have only one dose of measles, get them to use two doses of measles, because that will stop their mortality.
You're talking about inoculations.
Inoculation, yes, and we provide actually very safe devices. We give devices that you can only use once. So while we implement this, roll out this huge program, we are able to bring new technology to the countries and make sure that kids that are getting a vaccination actually get it with a safe injection equipment.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. John Hoekstra at the United Nations. A lot of folks probably are asking, why measles?
Yeah.
You know, I had measles as a kid. It seemed like no big deal. There is a relation, though, between measles and birth defects, is there not?
Well, your observation is exactly right. In the industrialized world, measles is not a big thing. Maybe still 1 out of 1,000 kids would die, even in our countries, and 1 out of 1,000 would actually be blind for their lives. But in general, it's not seen as a big problem in the Western. But that is very different in the developing country. In the developing country, we have situations where kids are malnourished, so they have little resistance. If they get measles, and measles is like a autoimmune disease, kind of a full-blown AIDS for 1 month. For 1 month, the child has a very bad immune system. So in that month, usually the child has a good chance of getting a lung infection, pneumonia, or getting diarrhea. And that because these kids in these remote areas have very limited access to health care, they actually die if they had access to antibiotics, which you had when you were young, and or to have a drip, then we could save those kids. But we could also give them just a shot of an extra shot of measles vaccine, and that does the job just as well.
Dr. John Hoekstra, what other diseases are there that the UN is working on? I think everybody's familiar with its work on AIDS.
Yes.
But what are the other diseases that you see as things that we should be paying attention to? And what's the situation with regard to the United Nations getting funding for these things?
Yes. Well, UNICEF, I work for UNICEF, and UNICEF is mainly focused on children. And for children, the main issues are HIV is becoming more and more an issue, but the big real issue out there is malaria. Malaria issues and infectious diseases, and as respiratory diseases. Now, what we've been doing, we've been scaling up the measles activities, and we've actually already reduced, there were about 6 years ago, there were about almost 1 million children died worldwide. Can you imagine 1 million children of measles? And we have scaled that back already to 50%, which is still too much. It's a bit more than 400,000 kids die now. But the program is in that way very successful. So successful that the countries have decided that they will actually now give bed nets at the same time.
What about funding? What about funding?
The funding is a different issue. We have, listeners, people giving us money, and they can always reach us at 1-800-4-UNICEF, and the 4 is a number, so 1-800-4-UNICEF for donating.
Because UNICEF operates on...
But we have also even the Canadian, the American government, we work very closely with the International Red Cross and the American Red Cross, as well as with the CDC, Centers for Disease Control in America.
Does UNICEF receive most of its funding through and from the United Nations or from private contributions?
Most of it is from the governments, but for the measles, most of it actually comes from private sector and from actually American Red Cross and the UN Foundation, actually from Ted Turner, is providing, and Bill Gates, are all providing a lot of funds directly to us.
That's great. We have to wrap it up there. Dr. John Hoekstra, thank you for being with us with UNICEF and Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall. The cavalry was quiet except for the drilling in the wall. The cavalry had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. On this day in history, Robert F. Kennedy was buried. June 8th, 1968. Bobby Kennedy laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. One of my favorite speeches of Bobby Kennedy's, here's about a minute and a half of it, about gross domestic product. This is also one of his most famous, and rightfully so.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community value in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck's knife and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
Well said, Robert F. Kennedy, on this day in history, laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. Well, as promised...
It's good to be king.
Yeah. Somebody said, hey, Tom, you ought to be king. Let me tell you my quick king story, and we'll get to your phone calls here. Some years ago, I was in Australia, and Jeff Guest, a fellow who's half Aboriginal, he's in his 70s. Jeff was part of the Stolen Generation. He had been taken by the police because he had a white father and an Aboriginal mother, and at the age of three, and put into an orphanage, so that they would, you know, they didn't want to contaminate, to pollute the white race. Right, this was the whole thing in Australia at the time, and he grew up there until he was about 10 years old. Then he ran away, and when he was 5 years old, they sold him to a sheep farmer, a ranch, and who used him as slave labor and used to beat him quite badly. And when Jeff was 10, he ran away from the farmer, and out in the bush met up with an Aboriginal trapper and traveled all over Australia with this guy for many years, learning several Aboriginal languages and learning the ways of the bush and all this kind of thing. And Jeff is now considered one of the Aboriginal elders of Australia. So I asked, and I was asking Jeff, you know, is there anybody around who really remembers the old stories? And Jeff said, well, there's this guy, King Tommy George, lives way up in the north. And I said, oh, I'd love to meet him. So we took Jeff's Range Rover or whatever it was. He's got this vehicle that's actually got the air intake up above the roof. I mean, we went through rivers where the water was up above the windows, you know, over the hood of the car. And went for 4 days, took us to drive from Petford up into the Lockhart River area and way up in the north part of Queensland. And which is more and more warm as you go north in Australia. Until we found this community where King Tommy George lived. And he's an old guy. He looks like he's 100 years old. And he's got a nimbus of white hair. And we were sitting in his power place, which was this dried-up riverbed out in the bush. And there were these three kids sitting. And we were all squatting. That's how he sits. And we were all kind of squatting in this riverbed. And he's telling me about the initiations, the series of initiations that Aboriginals go through. And there's one that occurs when you're, 6-7 years old, when you're kind of the age of knowledge. And one that occurs, and in each initiation, you have a mentor, somebody who takes responsibility for you. There's one that happens when you hit puberty, physical puberty. There's one that happens when you get married. There's one that happens when you have your first gray hairs. And there's one that happens when all of the hair on your head turns white. And this old man, King Tommy George, he says to me, and that's the most important. Well, actually, his speech was so thickly Australian accented that I could hardly understand it. But I actually have a tape recording of this someplace. Anyhow, he says, and that's when the most important knowledge, the greatest secrets, the greatest power is given to you. And the greatest knowledge is given to you. And so being a stupid American, I said, oh, great, tell me what those secrets are. And he got this shocked look on his face and totally serious said, you wouldn't want me to do that. He said, if I told you those secrets, he said, all the hair on your head is not yet white. You're not ready. If I told you those secrets, you would burst into flames. It's a culture that honors wisdom. Well, about a third of my hair is white now, so I'm getting gray, so I'm looking forward to the day when I can be a king like King Tommy George and I can learn the final secrets. Anyhow, that's my king story following up in the last hour. Thomas in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Thomas, what's on your mind today?
Well, like I said, I just was watching all the media blitz over the terrorists caught in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just interesting how the American politicians and the American news media is now screaming, oh, my God, there's terrorists right across the border, where we know that there's terrorist cells in the United States. They're in Mexico. They're in England. They exist everywhere. So rather than saying, good job to the Canadian security forces, you caught the terrorists, it's now, oh my God, now we need stricter security and now we need a defended border. It's completely the wrong way of thinking. Rather than congratulating a job well done, it's strange, knee-jerk reactionary that now the world is falling apart because these people exist, but we already know they exist.
Well, here's the problem, Thomas. Here's the problem that the Bush administration is facing.
Yep.
They rule by fear. The only thing that gives Bush legitimacy is if he can keep people afraid, because they don't have anything to offer us. I mean, they've rolled back they want to roll back all of. They haven't been successful, but, you know, with Social Security, for example, roll back all of our social protections. We don't have national health care here like you do in Canada. Our Social Security system is under attack. All of this stuff. And we got guys like Rush Limbaugh out there saying, going on and on and on about how, you know, Roosevelt is dead and get over
it. Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So these guys have nothing to offer the American people except fear. And the only way that they can hold power is by having fear. And so if the Canadians do something, they've got to figure out a way to turn it into a fear soundbite rather than a, oh, we can relax, the Canadians are doing a good job soundbite. Because they can't afford people to relax, because if they do, those people then might vote Democratic.
And not only that, but if you see someone else doing a good job and it doesn't look like your own side is doing the good job, then it makes you look like a bigger moron.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Thomas, thank you for the call.
If they really want to fear, they should just let people see Bush as he really is, and people would be very frightened.
Yeah, there you go. You're well said. And that's the problem, is the rest of the world sees Bush as he really is, because they don't have the cowardly news media that we do here in the United States.
Even just a little bit on the BBC or a little bit on the CBC could really open some of the Americans' eyes.
Oh, I know. When we lived in Vermont, we just lived just 2 hours south of the Canadian border, and we had CBC News on our cable system. And it was just amazing. I'd watch the nightly news on an American network, and then I'd watch the CBC News, and it was like two different worlds I was watching.
And it really is.
It really is, yeah. Thomas, thank you for the call.
Bye,
and talk to you later. Tony in Queens, New York. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thank you. I worked on the RFK campaign, and I also worked on the JFK campaign. But the reason I called you was I worked Sunday. I talked to 200 people in California. I didn't talk to 200 people. I made 200 calls to California for moveon.org. Mm-hmm. And I talked to at least 50, 40 of whom told me they voted for Francine Busby by absentee ballot.
Right. In fact, the progressives and the Democrats were more likely to use absentee ballots because they didn't trust the machines. And right now, they have not yet counted those absentee ballots. In fact, David Poole, my producer, just called the Secretary of State's office in California. And keep in mind, Francine Busby lost by about 4,500 votes.
Right.
And according to some news reports, there's as many as 60,000 absentee votes that have not yet been counted. And when he called the Secretary of State's office, they said, yes, in fact, there are absentee votes that have not been counted. They would not give him a number.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they will count them and they will report back. And in fact, their PR department says they're going to call.
Yeah, judging from the number of people that I talked to people, and then they this thing that I did for Move On was incredible because I did it from my house.
Yeah.
And I did it online. You have to have an internet connection where you can use the telephone at the same time.
But you found that 4 out of 5 of the people you talked to said that they were going to vote absentee for Busby.
They did already, and they all voted for her.
Yeah.
And
okay, well, then what we need to do is call the California Secretary of State's office and say, are you going to count those absentee votes? Because we have to get those things. Yeah, well, hopefully they're doing it right now. 45 minutes past the hour. Thank you, Tony, and thanks for the great work that you did. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Feeling so different in each and every way, but I'm finding my way back home.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECOWINE. Welcome back to our program, 10 minutes before the hour. And our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Your first caller, Mike, I think he's drinking the Kool-Aid that anyone who isn't conservative is depressed about the cowboys being killed.
Yeah, well, what's sad about it is that Mike thought that he was going to score some kind of talking point by being sarcastic and trying to attack me personally. And it's just, it rolls off.
Well, they conflate earnest analysis with depression. And here's depression.
Yeah.
Oh, man, they only killed their cowboy. We're doomed. Let's go hide in a cave. Let's have group therapy and sing kumbaya. But I think we're saying it's a great day for our military. I personally hope that this is the turning point we've been promised for 3 years, and in fact, if it's such a measure of great success, oh joy, let's redeploy, and let's let the Iraqis take control of their own destiny and bring the troops home. Now,
if the
Bush brats don't agree with that assessment, are they depressed?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Well said.
And did you hear Tom Mark Rally on Air America this morning?
No, I didn't.
Well, he said, and I hope I'm getting this correctly because I was working out and it was 6 o'clock in the morning. He said that 22 hours before Zarqawi was killed, an article on a conservative website called, Strategy Page. Yeah, strategypage.com reported that other al-Qaeda members disagreed with Zarqawi's call for more Shiite bloodshed, instead of focusing on the United States and Israel, and that they were ready to give up Zarqawi's whereabouts to the United States military while creating a martyr in the process.
Right.
Did you hear that?
No, but they're over at Al-Qaeda, or Al Jazeera, rather, excuse me, a very different organization. AlJazeera.com, they're talking about that. Yeah, the news reports that, yes, that apparently this was an inside job that, well, actually over at Think Progress, actually, they mentioned. Update also yesterday, Prime Minister Maliki finally filled the remaining security position. Oh, that's unrelated. Here we go. Update two. Reports from U.S. military officials indicate Zarqawi was exposed by those closest to him, suggesting an internal power struggle. General George W. Casey, the top U.S. military commander in Iraq, said, quote, tips and intelligence from Iraqi senior leaders from his network led forces to al-Zarqawi and some of his associates who were conducting a meeting when the airstrike was launched.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was very interesting. Now, that doesn't take anything away from our military, okay? So we're not depressed Bushbots out there. You know, I just think it's interesting to understand, you know, what's going on in that part of the world.
Yeah, yeah, well said. Bonnie, thanks a lot for the call.
Bye.
Much appreciated. Also in Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT, Gary in Pittsburgh. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. The Republicans, if I may say, and corporate America, they remind me of the my late father told me this a long time ago. Remind me of the man who would give you a wiener for a ham.
Oh, yeah. Presumably the wiener for the less value.
Isn't that great? But anyway, I just wish there was more outrage. And we should vote these people out, whether a Democrat or Republican. They're mostly Republicans who voted for this latest tax cut. That is so wrong, and considering the repeal of the estate tax.
Yeah, right now they
vote them right out of office.
Right now they are debating whether or not they should give Paris Hilton a huge tax cut. I mean, right now the Paris Hilton tax cut, the estate tax, they're debating that thing right now, whether or not they should do away with the estate tax and give another tax cut to Paris Hilton. I think it's wrong.
Here in Pennsylvania, we did knock off, as you probably know, three leaders here of the Republican legislature who were first in voting themselves a tax cut, not a tax cut, but a pay raise. So this is the realistic way. They have to have an incentive to change their ways. And unless America steps up to the plate,
they're going to stick around. Yeah, I know. I'm absolutely with you, Gary. We have to get involved. And by the way, 100 members of Congress, that's about 1 in 5, is a multimillionaire and will benefit from the Paris Hilton tax cut, plus Bush, plus Cheney. All of them will benefit if the estate tax is done away with. About 1 out of 5 members of Congress. Rick in Grand Rapids. Hey, Rick, we just have a minute left. What's up?
Well, I probably won't have time to get through it then, but I like your analysis there of every protagonist being an antagonist.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if we could extrapolate that, and this is kind of off the wall maybe and too heavy, especially for a minute, but I just wonder maybe in a future show you could comment on whether this goes to the ultimate, and that's with Jehovah and Satan. In other words, I'm saying it in a twofold.
Oh, of course.
Well,
of course, in all the world's major religions, you find that there are anti-religious beings or symbols or entities or powers that have almost the power of the ultimate religious figure.
Okay, but then
and you find that in the mythology of virtually every. I mean, this is intrinsic to human nature.
Next question would be: does God Himself? People will always say, "Well, why did God create Satan? Did God Himself create a Satan so He'd have somebody bad to make Himself look better?"
Well, you know, I'm not going to get into the theological
point
on
that. Well, that's a tough one, I know, but
yeah,
maybe a future show.
Yeah, yeah. But the simple fact of the matter is that George W. Bush needed a Satan. He needed a negative figure out there for himself to become godlike.
Stalin needed a Trotsky.
Yeah, well, not only that, Stalin needed the communists. Or Stalin, rather, needed the Nazis. Stalin, I mean, you know, Hitler worked tremendously to Stalin's benefit.
Sure.
And Stalin worked tremendously to Hitler's benefit. There was a clear symbiosis there. We in the Soviet Union, the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about and the Soviet Union, absolutely, right across the board. Rick, interesting question. Thank you for calling. And thanks for listening on WTKG there in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after this with more of your calls, more of the news of the day, what's going on in Iraq, what's happening with Zarqawi, why is this going on, and the latest on the elections. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Well, the Paris Hilton tax cut seems to have failed in the United States Senate. Congratulations to our senators for having the courage of their convictions and voting against the interests of at least 20% of their own community who would have benefited from the Paris Hilton tax cut, also known as the death tax or the estate tax, from the repeal of it. The repeal of the estate tax, which you could call the repeal of the estate tax, the Paris Hilton tax cut. So, yeah, good on them. In the meantime, the federal government, this is the Associated Press, just out. The federal government should guarantee that all Americans have basic health insurance coverage, says a committee set up by Congress. Now, this goes back to 2003. In 2003, when the Medicare prescription drug benefit was passed, one of the bones that got thrown to everybody, or to the, you know, to the rest of us, as it were, one of the bones that got thrown to us by the cons, they said, okay, you give us a law that says that the federal government cannot negotiate drug prices but has to buy them from the pharmaceutical companies who are contributing money to our campaigns at full retail. Billions of dollars worth of drugs at full retail. You give us that, Billy Towson said, before he went off to work for pharma, for the drug industry's lobbying firm. You give us that, and we'll throw you a bone. We'll approve $5.5 million, chump change. Right? It's like, you know, three hours worth of spending on the pharmaceutical bill. We'll give you some chump change to set up a working group. It's called the Citizens Healthcare Working Group, to go out and ask the American people what they want. And they did. The group consisted of 14 members representing consumers, the disabled, business, and labor, and healthcare providers. And they held hearings around the United States. This is the Citizens Healthcare Working Group. 50 communities, listened to 23,000 people, and came up with a final analysis. And what they determined was that what Americans want is the same thing that every other industrialized country in the world has had for decades, national universal health care. As the Associated Press writes, assuring health care is a shared social responsibility, says the interim report of the Citizens Healthcare Working Group. The committee describes its recommendations as a framework. The recommendations don't say who would pay for universal health coverage or how much it would cost. The concept of government-guaranteed coverage runs counter to the Bush administration's position that consumers should bear more responsibility for their initial medical expenses. I mean, talk about being out of touch. At the same time that the Bush administration, at the same time that the American public is saying, we would like national health care, thank you very much. We even, according to a Pew poll, almost 80% of Americans said they'd be willing to pay more taxes for national health care. We'd even be we're paying for it already. It's being taken out of our paychecks. And we're paying for it with our taxes for those people who don't have insurance, who are showing up in the emergency room for a $300 visit that could have been a $10 doctor visit if they had a health insurance. So we're paying for it already. At the same time that we, the people of the United States, have been saying, ever since 1947, ever since 1947, the first time that Harry Truman proposed a national health care system for the United States, at the same time he was helping institute one for Germany and institute one for Japan with the Marshall Plan, at the same time he proposed one for the United States, and the Republicans, who had just taken control of the House and Senate, shot it down and said, no way. We got friends who want to make money off people being sick. So here we have, what, 60 years now, 59 years that the American people have been saying, we would like a national health care program, and the cons have been holding it off. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, ran this, you know, helped set up this committee that went out to 50 communities around the country, heard from 23,000 people, and came to the conclusion that we should have a national health care program. The same time that the American people are saying, give us national health care. What's George Bush saying? He's saying, we're going to give you the ability to save $2,000 a year in a special kind of account that will be, you know, in stocks or bonds or something like that, and will be run by a bank, which will take skim a little bit of the money off the top, because the bankers, after all, the second largest donors behind the oil companies to the Bush administration and the Republican Party in general. And we will let you do that, so that if you get sick and you have a quarter million dollar, $500,000 health bill, you'll have that $2,000 in your health savings account. Won't that help you out? You get how out of touch these people are? I mean, how absolutely flaming out of touch. And what are they debating in Congress? They're debating gay marriage and a tax cut for Paris Hilton. Meanwhile, Americans are not even certain that their election system is safe. I get this email from Alex in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. Thanks for your show. Thanks for talking on this subject, this voting issue. I moved from a rich white neighborhood in Manhattan to a poor black neighborhood in Springfield, Mass. In 2003. I always vote my whole life. When I first moved here, I registered to vote. They never sent it in, so I wasn't able to vote in the presidential primaries. I registered again. For the presidential election, there was some problem, and the only way to fix it was to send a letter or something. I can't remember exactly what they said the problem was, how it would be remedied. The last election was for mayor. I went to vote. Again, they said there was a problem, and they don't know what it is. The woman showed me this sheet of my entire street. Now, keep in mind, Alex has moved to a poor black neighborhood in Springfield, Mass. They showed me the sheet of my entire street, and almost all of the addresses were marked as unable to vote. My wife and almost all of my neighbors were not counted. The only way to fix it, she said, is to take a day off work and go to City Hall personally. A nearby white town called Northampton reported in their local newspaper how disappointing it was that Springfield's voter turnout was so low. I say it's infuriating that our votes are not counted. She says, I know you're extremely busy, but this has been bothering the hell out of me for years. When I lived in New York City, from the first stealing of the election by Bush, there were voting machines not working, voting booths not working, ballot boxes not picked up in neighborhoods like East New York and Brooklyn. This didn't only happen in Florida. I'm betting it happened all over the country. Thanks again, Alex. Thank you, Alex. And then this from Sean. Sean says, I wanted to say that you're making a mistake when you discuss election fraud and theft. The people who commit these acts are not, quote, breaking down the door and stealing the living room furniture, end quote. They, whoever they are preventing the lawfully elected government from taking power. There's a word for this, treason. It's a very strong word, but it's the correct one. Earlier today, you said you had two theories as to why Democrats were not up in arms over Robert Kennedy's article in Rolling Stone. Your first theory, that the Democrats want rigged elections themselves so that someday they can take advantage of it when they're in power. Or the other theory being that some big players didn't want John Kerry to win because he would lock up the presidency between him and John Edwards for 16 years. And they wouldn't have an opportunity to run. He says a third option, Sean writes, a third option is that people do not want to believe that it's possible that President Bush or cronies working for him would commit treason by stealing an election. I personally hope there was no fraud, but we must know the truth. We must be willing to investigate and find out what happened. We owe it to those who came before us and sacrificed so much for freedom. We owe it to our children, our future, and we owe it to ourselves. Sean writes, there's a passage in the Bible that says the truth shall set you free. I believe we need to know the truth about our voting systems, no matter the outcome. I pray we are not too late. Thanks for the excellent work you do. You're an inspiration to me and many others. Thank you, Sean. Thanks for your kind note. David Poole, my producer, is here. David, you called the California Secretary of State's office about the election. Yeah. What happened?
They just said that they didn't have all the provisional ballots in and that they would be counted and that they would get back to me if they thought there would be a change in the election from that.
Now, we had a person call in. You were out of the studio when it happened, who said that they called for moveon.org. They spent the whole day calling people and trying to get people out to vote for Francine Busby.
Mm-hmm.
And that four out of five of the people they called said that they'd already voted by provisional ballot because the Democrats and liberals didn't trust the voting machines. So there's got to be a lot of provisional ballots for Francine, and yet and she only lost by about 4,500 votes.
Yeah.
Did the Secretary of State's office in California give you any indication when these ballots will be counted?
They did not. They wouldn't tell me how many there were, and they wouldn't tell me when they would be counted. They did say they would be counted, but that's all they told me.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, let me encourage, thank you, David. Let me encourage our listeners here to contact the Secretary of State's office in California and the city office in San Diego and find out, you know, what's the deal with these provisional ballots? How many are there? When are they going to be counted? What I'm seeing on MSNBC website is that there's 68,000 of them. This is an election that was decided by 4,500 votes. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve somebody.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Congratulations to the folks who pushed through the passage of Measure T, corporations now not being able to participate in elections in those communities in California, those few communities, but it's a start. It's good on you. In fact, we're going to have to get Caitlin back on, or David Cobb, one of those folks, to talk about it in more detail. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, you know something about the election there?
Yeah, I made a few calls to the Registrar of Voters here in San Diego County and talked to David Martin, who forwarded me over to Kathy Glazer over there, who said that they're not done counting yet. There are indeed 68,000 outstanding ballots across the county, but we're heavily skewed and we're population heavy in the coast and not so much in the East County. So there'll probably be a lot of ballots in there for the 50th district. They're going to
the 50th district being Busby's district.
At SD Vote, that's San Diego SDVote.com, at 5 p.m. tonight and every night, well, and Monday night, and they will have the certified results on June 30th. However, Tom, and this is where my question for you comes in. Francine Busby has already called Brian Bilbray. This is on the front page, Union Tribune, at signonsandiego.com, has accepted Francine Busby's concession call. Tom, why? 68,000 outstanding ballots. That's what Kathy told me. 68,000. Why would she concede?
I don't know. Unless she has the same advisors that John Kerry had.
I don't know who her advisors were. I didn't get to see any of them or really hear their names, so I was sitting back on the volunteer end.
So it's going to be June 30th before they certify this thing. Today is June 8th.
Exactly. Exactly. They're counting still. They're counting.
Well, you know, there's ballots. There's provisional ballots in Ohio that still have not been counted. Are you still there, Scott?
I think they're going to count them all. By the way.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they're going to count them all. I mean, in Ohio, they just said, okay, that's it, we're stopped. And I believe that there's just a little short of 100,000 that never did get counted in Ohio.
Well, that was my specific question for Kathy. I said, even if Francine has conceded, if that is true, will you still count it? She said, absolutely. We have to certify the vote.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible. I mean, this is an election that was won or lost by 4 or 5%, by 4 or 5 thousand votes.
There's a little over 5,000 votes, I think, when I saw the results there.
And there's 68,000 in the county, and what percentage of the county is the district?
It's pretty large. The 50th has a high population density. It's some of the more popular cities like La Jolla, Encinitas, Lucadia, those areas are very
popular. I mean, so
popular.
Would you guess that, you know, if there's 68,000 outstanding ballots in the county, that means there's what, 50,000 that are for that district, or 20,000, or, you know?
Well, at least that, Tom, they did a really heavy campaign. They started off with a phone call asking you to vote absentee. Then they sent you mail
really?
With your absentee ballot. Then they followed up and asked you to sign the absentee ballot and send it in. If you didn't, they sent you another letter reminding you to send in your absentee
ballot. This is the Busby campaign?
That up with a phone call.
This is the Francine Busby campaign?
This is the Francine Busby campaign. This was a really, really heavy get out the vote and do absentee ballots. Why she would concede at this point without counting what she had spent so much money doing has me baffled.
Well, David's going to be calling. We have tried to call her campaign office. David is trying again as we speak to get a hold of Francine Busby's campaign office and find out why she has conceded when all the votes haven't been counted.
Well, especially when she spent, and this is a lot of money to do this, to go back and forth with that registration. Why would she let it all go?
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Scott, keep us up to date, would you?
Sure. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much.
I
appreciate the call. Yeah. Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Tom,
yeah.
I was just calling you to touch on something you brought up earlier.
Yeah.
And that was the what the Senate and the Senate is debating at this time. Gay marriage?
Oh, well, actually, they finished. The gay marriage amendment failed, but they were debating yesterday, yeah.
What I would like to know, and I've tried to find it on the Internet, is how many debates were there between 2004 and 2006 on gay marriage? You know, I mean...
None.
That's what I thought.
The last time the words came out of George Bush's mouth was 1 week before the 2004 election.
That's what I thought, because I tried to find it in the... my opinion is that George Bush does not care about gay marriage.
No, I don't think he does either.
Yeah.
I think
well,
in his personal
that's
life,
what I wanted to find out. Just
yeah, I think in his
I
personal
guess.
Life, he's probably fairly tolerant of gays. As much as I dislike George W. Bush, one of the things that I suspect he's probably not is particularly bigoted. And, you know, damn him with faint praise, I suppose. But, you know, so, yeah, this is a wedge issue, pure and simple. And, you know, that's it. Michael, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Will in Seattle. Hey, Will, just a few seconds left. What's up?
I just wanted to say.
Actually, Will, let me. I thought I had a minute more than I did. Will, let me put you back on hold, and we'll pick you up on the other side of the break here. We do have to take a break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. Why would she concede a vote when there's still 68,000 ballots to be counted? I'm still scratching my head. We're gonna track this thing down for you, my friends.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just altogether too strange. Francine Busby does a campaign that is based on getting people to send in absentee ballots, provisional not provisional ballots. That's when you show up and they don't have your name on the list, but send in absentee ballots. They send mailings to people's homes with a ballot, and then asking the person to send the ballot in. If the ballot doesn't come back in, they send another mailing saying, "Please send the ballot in." There are still 68,000 provisional ballots that have not been counted. And because her opponent got 4,500 votes more than she did, she conceded. David has called Francine Busby's office, the campaign headquarters, the PR person's home phone. We tried everybody. Nobody's answering the phone. We left voicemail. We'll see what happens. But if you're in or around San Diego or if whatever, I mean, I'm really curious. Why would you run a campaign, the basis of which was apparently successful, by the way, because then we had another call from San Diego, another person who called in and said that they had been working for MoveOn.org, calling voters in San Diego, asking them, did you vote for Busby? And four out of five of them said, yes, not only did I vote for her or will I vote for her, but I already voted for her by sending in that absentee ballot. Why would you run a campaign based on absentee ballots and then concede the election before the absentee ballots are counted? This really stinks. Somebody needs to be looking into this. I mean, we're doing our best here, but we have to have listeners in San Diego. Well, I know we do. We've heard from two of them already who've called into the program. Let's find. Please, if you can get any information on this, let us know. I'd love to write up a piece about this for Common Dreams. First, we have to get a hold of their campaign. We can't get anybody from their campaign to call us. If you know the phone number for anybody involved with the Busby campaign, give them our phone number, have them call us, drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com and post the information. Send it to me or David as an email. I'm Tom at TomHartmann.com. David's David at TomHartmann.com. T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's. Get us the information. We'll follow up on it. Paul in Anchorage, Alaska, listening on KUDO. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Oh, wonderful. Gosh, what an honor to get on your show. Mr. Hartman, I think you are fabulous. And anyway, what I'm calling about is I was listening to a local talk show, and our representative, Don Young, was on, and somebody called in about Haditha and what he thought should be done about the situation in Haditha. Right. And his comment was, well, I've never been there. I paraphrase, you know. I've never been there, so I don't think I can comment on it at all. And I don't know anything about it. And, of course, I ended up calling in. I thought, well, you know, that's just absurd that a representative says that I've never been there, so I can't comment on it either. But I quoted from, when I called in, I quoted from Democracy Now!, dated May 30th, when they had a special report on Haditha. Dar Jamal, also I mentioned that Dar Jamal is a reporter from Anchorage, Alaska, who has been over there. And the essence of the show was that this is a daily occurrence. Haditha is not something that is that happened and is an anomaly. It's something that goes on every day in Iraq.
There is reporting to that effect. In fact, there's a piece on commondreams.org right now, a news piece to that effect. Not literally every day, but relatively common.
Right,
And on the other hand, there is reporting that, no, that's not the case. I frankly don't know. What we do know is that we are illegally in Iraq. We are illegally occupying Iraq. We illegally invaded Iraq. That thousands of American soldiers have died as a result of George W. Bush lying us into an illegal war. And we're not helping Iraq by staying there. It's time for us to, as Jack Murtha said, redeploy beyond the horizon and give the Iraqis an opportunity to put their own country together however they want it.
Well, the Haditha thing happened in November. Nothing was said about it until the Time magazine report in March. In March, there was also another massacre that took place. We showed the film, an edited version of the film last night. And I think one of the things that the people said in the film, this is from Democracy Now!, is that, you know, we shouldn't hold the soldiers responsible for this. It's the commanders who should be held responsible.
Well, and, in my opinion, both need to be held responsible, but we need to be holding the President of the United States responsible as well, but in particular Don Rumsfeld, because he's the one who organized this, well, let's run them through three tours of duty in a mind-numbing urban guerrilla warfare environment. I mean, it's just absolutely wrong. Paul, thanks for the call. I appreciate it and for raising the topic. This is important stuff. It's very important stuff. Rosalind in Orange County, California. Hey, Rosalind, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Yes, I was just listening earlier when somebody said, or maybe you said that the people in San Diego that didn't want to use the machines were given provisional ballots.
Yeah.
And I was a poll worker. I'm in Orange County. And I was a poll worker on Tuesday. And anybody that showed up at our polls that did not want to use the machines, we gave them a paper ballot because that's what we were trained to do.
Right.
And I can't believe that we were trained any differently than other people in the state. So those people that got provisional ballots, that's just crazy.
Right. And what's really crazy is that San Diego is saying that the provisional ballots, and some 68,000 of them apparently, have not yet been counted.
Right, I read that.
And this is a race where the two people who, you know, the two people running both got in the neighborhood of 50 or 60,000 votes each. It was separated by 5,700 votes, more,
right.
4,700, fewer than 5,000 votes, and there's 68,000 uncounted provisional ballots?
Exactly. And, you know, we were watching this race very carefully here in Orange County because a lot of the people in South Orange County are in that district. Because it comes up that far. And
right.
So there were people in the very south part of Orange County that voted for her. And
right.
There were a lot of people here in Orange County that went down there and worked on her campaign and volunteered
right.
for her.
Right. And,
so, yeah, there are a lot of people that were watching that race very carefully up here.
Well, there's a lot of us who are scratching our heads right now because it certainly sounds, and I hope I'm not jumping the gun here or going off half-cocked, but it certainly sounds like there's something very, very wrong.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
You know, this is not to overuse cliche, but this is a rush to judgment, if nothing else. It's pretty amazing. Rosalind, thank you for the information. Thanks for the call. And thanks for showing up and being a poll worker there in Orange County. That's great.
Yeah,
you're a volunteer for democracy. I salute you for it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Tom in Eureka, California. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you again. At the top of the hour on the network news, I heard the Republican line, which I've heard before, in regards to the estate tax, that the estate tax has put family farms out of business. Now,
yes, and 2 years ago, the New York Times wanted to do an article about that, and they went to the Chamber of Commerce and the Farm Bureau, and they said, we'd like to start the story out, as we always do, you know, with a personal story. You know, Joe Blow and his wife looked sadly at their family farm as it went on the auction block after Joe's dad died, right? They couldn't find one. Nationwide, couldn't find one.
That is why I was calling you. I thought it was on your show that I had heard that story. So how do we get maybe one of those two reporters that from the Talk News Network that call you? How do we get someone to say to Bill Frist, okay, show us one?
Well, first of all, the debate is over now. The Paris Hilton tax cut, also known as repealing the capital gains cut, just failed about an hour and a half ago in the Senate.
But they should still be called on their lie.
Oh, I agree. And you can find the information over at thinkprogress.org, by the way. Yeah, I'll try to remember to bring it up the next time, you know, tomorrow when we talk with Victoria Jones or Ellen Ratner.
I would love to hear some Republican senator stutter and stammer when asked to present one family farmer.
I would too. And Tom, if I forget to, there's just a million things going on here. Just remind me again, okay?
I will.
Thanks a lot, Will in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Will, what's up?
I think your program is great, by the way.
Thank you, Will.
But I'd like to comment, not to change topics or anything, but yesterday I received.
That's okay. We're hopping all over the place here today.
I received an email that you subscribed to for the DNC. Anyway, it was supposedly from Howard Dean himself, which, you know, we all know isn't true. But at any rate, it was a message to send on encouragement to Al Gore on his movie and all that stuff because he's being vast. And I just thought, with all the issues that are facing us, why am I getting an email encouraging me to encourage Al Gore about something that we're all compassionate about? But it's just beyond me.
Well, it may be that the end of life on Earth is a pretty big issue.
Well, it's a big issue. I know that. Everybody knows that, at least that I talk to.
I don't think everybody does.
My point is that, why are we wasting time with that? Well, Rome burns. We're trying to congratulate or encourage Al Gore. I think he's doing a great job all by himself.
Well, I can't speak for Howard Dean, Will, but what I would say is that personally, I think that the best hope for the Democratic Party in 2008 is to put Al Gore at the top of the ticket, is to run Al Gore for president. And if this is the first kind of crack in the door of a process of the institutional Democratic Party trying to bring Al Gore in and get him out there as a presidential candidate, I'm all in favor of it.
I would be in favor of that too, but what I want to see coming out of the Democrats is information on the issues, not congratulatory memos or emails on something that's on the table.
Yeah, I get your point, Will. I get your point. And it's a good point. It's a good point. And I encourage you to let Howard Dean know. Dixie in Seattle, Washington, and thank you for calling us. Dixie in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dixie, what's up?
I can't understand why this woman conceded either, because now when Maria Cantwell ran up here, well, the first time she ran for Congress, she fought right down to the wire, you know, recounted everything twice.
Yeah, and look at what happened in the governor's race.
To the bitter end.
Yeah, there you go.
And I'm all for that. I'm ready to stand the corner and root till
Yeah,
you know, freezes over, but...
Yeah, I just have to think that Busby is getting advice from the DLC or something. I mean, I don't get it, Dixie, I don't get it. But we're going to find out, I'm telling you. We're going to get to the bottom of this if somebody else doesn't first. And if they do first, then we'll report. 46 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, Mr. Politician, there's no debate. He already separated church and state. Your religion should never abuse or take away my freedom to choose.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, referring to what I would call Fradycrats right now.
Yeah, the Democratic Party?
Yeah. There's a strange thing. I mean, Kerry is one of the biggest mysteries, I think, in my lifetime. Is like, one is, why during the entire campaign did he not mention BCCI?
And yeah, when he was the guy who busted open the investigation.
Yeah, he single-handedly fought terrorism and took down this bank, basically. And he never mentioned it during his campaign. I mean, terrorism is one of the biggest...
I think it's because his advisors were telling him the American people, A, don't pay attention to the news, B, don't remember what BCCI is, and C, are stupid. You've got to talk in sound bites, and you've got to talk like the Republicans do. And that's what he tried to do. He tried to be Republican light, and he shot himself in the foot. Although, again, if the exit polls are right, Kerry won by millions of votes, and
Why did he concede?
Right. And the only two reasons that I can come up with, the only reason that I can come up with for why John Kerry conceded the election was because he was being advised by people whose agenda was actually a loyalty to somebody other than John Kerry. Somebody else in the Democratic Party who wanted to run for president in 2008 and knew that if Kerry won, Kerry would probably be president for 8 years, and then John Edwards, who's young and a strong candidate, would probably be president for the next 8 years, and whoever that person might be whose loyalty those people, those Kerry advisors had, did not want John Kerry to win, frankly.
Yeah. And one of the things I see...
It's a total nutcase conspiracy theory, and if anybody can come up with anything that makes any more sense to me, I would love to hear it. But you do Occam's razor, and that's what it comes down to.
Exactly. It's like they didn't want him to win, and I see that with other things. But one of the things I see all the time within the party, is especially by the people who have been in there a while, when we say things, say, impeach Bush, let's even say those words, they go, oh, we don't want to be contentious.
Right.
There's a whole thing of not wanting to be contentious, and you know, the party rank and file... There, you know, it's like when I've stood up and given speeches and say, hey, we got here because we've been wimpy. There's almost standing ovations on these types of things. You know, the party, the people don't want the party to be wimpy, but you know, the party in many cases, not every case, there are a lot of great people out there, but there are a lot of wimpy people, and again, I'll call them Fradycrats.
Yeah, okay. Well said, Jeff. Thanks a lot for the call. Here's Senator Joe McCarthy, speaking of tactics. I mean, it's like what goes around comes around. Joe McCarthy in the 1950s.
Using not merely the communists, but the fellow travelers, the deluded liberals, the eggheads, and some of my good friends in both the Democrat and Republican parties, who can become heroes overnight in the eyes of the left-wing press, if they will join with the jackal pack,
the left-wing press. These are not new memes, my friends. And then he pounds his fist on the table.
Traitors are not gentlemen, my good friends. They don't understand being treated like gentlemen.
There you go. And I would say that the people who stole the election in Ohio are traitors, and they are not gentlemen, and they don't understand what it means. Julie in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Julie.
Hey, Tom. Hey, thank you so much for all you do. I just want to let you know, I did call the DNC a day before yesterday and was inquiring about had they read the article by Bobby Kennedy, and if not, why not. And the woman was really great. She referred me she said there were two people that were investigating this. One happened to be, from the National Lawyers Council,
right.
But just two people on it. And then also I've called Reid's office and Pelosi's office and just told them I'll just call every day until you can give me an answer what we plan on doing. Where is our leadership?
Good idea, Julie.
You know, I mean, also, by the way, I also called Caitlin and said she did a great job and on your show the other day, and I'm glad that your proposition passed.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah, Caitlin did. Julie, thank you very much, and thanks for being a real patriot.
Well, thank you.
Getting out there and getting involved. Absolutely marvelous.
Thank you. Great
to hear from you. Thank you. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's on your mind? We have just about a minute before we've got to wrap up the show.
Yes, me too, because I have my little toddler here. I wanted to just basically show the Republican failed economics, where you have Senator Byron Dorgan is a great Democrat. He's trying to, in Senate Bill 196, he's trying to get rid of a law that we have right now that says if corporations take their jobs overseas, they get a tax break.
Right.
So, and I just suggest people to call the head of the Finance Committee. I think his name is Senator Chuck Grassley. He's a Republican from Iowa.
Right.
He's expected not to vote on this bill. So Republicans see that giving tax breaks to outsourcing jobs is a great thing. And once again, here we go. It's a failed economic policy in our country.
Oh, yeah. Failed is a gentle word for it, Patricia, because I would say this is the intentional dismemberment of the American middle class.
Absolutely.
I mean, Yeah. Patricia, thanks for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. We'll have to get in touch with Senator Dorgan's office. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, hold on to your seats as I challenge conservative David Tebow tomorrow in support of, he's supporting Ken Blackwell's emergency regulations that hit people with criminal penalties for registering voters. Congressman Bernie Sanders will be here tomorrow for Brunch with Bernie. He'll be taking your calls, that and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.